Good evening and welcome to WGCH's Legislative Forum. I'm Tony Savino. I'm joined by the Republican candidates for State Senate, 149th, 150th, and 151st House seats. And we hope to get the Democrats in at a later date to have a forum today. But joining me as we'll go around the building here, it's Ed Lopez, who is challenging Democratic incumbent Stephen Meskers in the 150th House seat. We also have former school board chairman Peter Scher, who is running for the open seat that Harry Arora is holding, but he's running for state treasurer, so it's an open seat. Hector Arzino running for the Democratic Party. 149th House seat, Republican incumbent Kimberly Fiorello being challenged by Rachel Khanna. And in the 36th State Senate, it's incumbent Republican Ryan Fazio against Democratic challenger Trevor Crow. And I want to welcome everybody to this evening's forum. Thanks very much, Ryan.
Thanks, Tony.
A little closer when we get to you, but we're going to start with Ed Lopez, Peter Scher, Kimberly Fiorello, then Ryan Lopez, or Ryan Fazio. All right, first question for Ed. Tell us about yourself and why you're running for office.
Sure, thanks, Tony. So I've been on the RTM for 5 years, and I also serve in the National Guard. I've been in the National Guard for a few years, but I was in the reserves before that. So I've done a lot of military work. And I also do work in public relations, focused on public affairs, a lot of national issues, but also a bit of entertainment relations. I play guitar, so I have a thing for artists and music and all that stuff. Basically, my wife and I moved to Greenwich about 7 years ago, and we've been trying to contribute to our community by, you know, with my service in the RTM and other volunteer roles that we've taken. And the reason I'm running for office is my biggest concern is how some things are changing in the town. You know, we moved here knowing what was important to Greenwich and what mattered to the residents of Greenwich and what has made the community a great place to live. And we see things coming from Hartford, and we see things that create hardship for people, especially in neighborhoods like ours. I live in Chickahominy, and Byram's the same. You know, we see how things are difficult for people in their pocketbook spaces. And basically, that's why I'm running for office and why I'm here talking to you right now.
All right, great. Thanks. Thank you. Okay, next is Peter Scher, and he is running for the open seat in the 150th. Let me get the numbers right here. I always get these wrong. It's the 151st seat. Sorry about that. Peter, running against Hector Arzino. This is the seat held by Harry Arora. Peter, why are you running for office? Tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're running for office.
Well, Tony, it's great to be with you again. I'm back in the studio. I remember being here many times from the Board of Education, and I didn't think I'd be quite back here doing this as quickly as turned out. But, of course, Harry Arora, who has served us so well in the 151st District, is now trying to go on and fix the finances of the state of Connecticut. I can't.
Peter, I'm gonna put you on hold for just a second. Your microphone doesn't seem to be working. I'm going to have you take Ed's and bring it around. There we go. Now we can hear
there
you.
There we go.
Okay, go right ahead.
What I was going to say is that, you know, Harry Arora, who has served us so ably in the 151st, has decided to go on and try to tackle the problem of fixing the state's finances. And thank goodness he's going to do that. But it left the seat open, and I decided to get back involved. I did not plan to get back involved when I left the Board of Education in December. But here I am. And I'm particularly doing it because I care about all these things that have made Greenwich the great community that it is. Karen and my wife and our kids have lived in Coscob and North Mayanis now for nearly 30 years. You know, there's so many great things about our state and our community. So many of our neighbors, unfortunately, because of the policies of a single-party rule up in Hartford, have bailed out for other states that are freer and more prosperous. I'm not prepared to do that. The reason I'm doing this is I love Connecticut. I love Greenwich. I love Fairfield County, and I want to go up to Hartford and try to push forward policies that will kind of restore to Connecticut to what it was when I first came here. It was very prosperous, great place to raise a family, great place to find a job. It was just a terrific place. It still is, but that's the reason I want to go up to Hartford is to work on that and preserve what's great about Greenwich and our great state.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Scher. Next up is Kimberly Fiorello, 149th House, running for a second term in office. A little bit more about yourself and why you're running.
Yeah, thank you, Tony. I'm Kimberly Fiorello, state representative for Greenwich and Stamford. Is it okay? It's working?
You're fine. Yeah, all right. You're fine. I'll let you know if you're not.
I'm here because I love this job. It's a hard job if done correctly, and I choose to do it the hard way. to read all the bills, to connect with subject matter experts, to always communicate with my constituents, to listen to them. I have four major priorities for this next year. It's about safety in our community. We know what happened on Greenwich Avenue, for example, the assault outside of Apple Store. It's about safety in our schools, safety in our neighborhoods, and it's about education. There is so much room to improve in education in our state. It's going to be so exciting when we can really ignite educational entrepreneurship and really a flourishing of the kinds of schools that can meet the needs of all of our parents in our communities in Greenwich and Stamford and across our state. And it's about local decision-making and keeping things local, trusting the people of our communities to make decisions for their future and directing the development of our towns. You know, we have a long history of self-determination in Connecticut, and I seek to continue to preserve the ability of our towns to make decisions for themselves. But really, the biggest issue is sound economics. You know, that's sort of hanging over all of the other goals that we have is we've got to be able to afford life here. You know, groceries are double, and the utilities, the water bills, health insurance, all of this. And there's a huge storm brewing at the federal level. And we have to make Connecticut a place where you can weather these storms that are brought on by federal policies. And we want to be content to build our lives in Connecticut without needing to have an exit plan. And that's why I'm here. Thanks,
all right.
Tony.
All right. Thanks, Kimberly. All right. Next up is going to be State Senator Ryan Fazio. Believe it or not, running for your first full term in office.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're running for another term.
Well, Tony, thanks for having me. We do our morning legislative updates the third Thursday every morning. So it's good to be here in studio with you in person.
Third Thursday of every month, not every morning. I don't know if I could take every morning.
Yeah, no one wants that much time with me, trust me.
Nor me, yeah.
Nevertheless, it's great to be here with you in person. I'm running for re-election for the same reason I ran in the first place. I love this community. I love this state. And I want to help deliver a state government that's equal to the caliber of the people in this community, which we've been lacking for a long time. I grew up here. I went to the public schools here. I've worked in Stamford most of my career in renewable energy. I've volunteered in the community, served in local government. But at the same time, I've always viewed the state government as problematic towards the community and the economy and opportunity here in southwestern Connecticut. And I figured that if I wanted a job done right, I should try to help do it myself. And so that's what led me to run for the state Senate. And since I've been in office for one term, I tried to go to work to reach across the aisle and accomplish common goals on behalf of our constituents. I wrote and helped pass a bill in order to improve student mental health in schools. I worked as the ranking member of the aging committee in order to protect the interests of our seniors in this district and around the state, co-sponsoring a bill to extend the statute of limitations for crimes against the elderly, and any number of other issues, trying to actually establish a alternative, a governing agenda for the economy of the state to reduce cost of living, reduce taxes, and create economic growth for all. There is a lot of challenges that we stand against as a state, but we have all the great attributes and assets as a community to face them down. So that's why I'm running for re-election and feel greater urgency than ever to do so.
All right. Thanks, Ryan. All right. We'll swing back to Ed Lopez, and we've heard from each of the we're going to take a break. We're going to check out that microphone, see if we can get that going again. So here on AM 1490, FM 105.5, WGCH, WGCH.com, anywhere. I'm Tony Savino, legislative forum, I should say, forum with the Republican candidates for office. Had the first question was basically why they're running. A lot of the candidates talked about what they'd like to see improved in the state of Connecticut. So we're going to go to Ed Lopez, who is running for the 150th House against Democratic incumbent Stephen Meskers. And so, Ed, tell us what you would do then to address these issues.
So as far as addressing issues that we think are important to us, For me, the critical thing is going back to Hartford and sending a message that we want to be able to make decisions locally. I think even the most well-intentioned things in Hartford in the end can end up creating issues when they're one size fits all. And all these communities are so different. You know, we know that New Haven's very different from Greenwich. We know that places up in the northeastern side of the state are very different. Sometimes it feels like a different state. And so for me, pushing back on these things and lending a voice to Greenwich, I feel like we have plenty of representation from Hartford and Greenwich. We understand what the Greenwich legislature wants, what the governor wants. We understand what big government wants, in a sense. We want to be able to go back there and say, this is what Greenwich residents want. This is what we want to improve in our town. And to me, it's most important to be that voice for people in my district.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Ed. Peter Scherer, get that microphone over there. Good. It's squeaking, so I can hear it's on the air. Tell us what you would address if elected, or how you would address the issues, I should say.
Yeah, I guess, Tony, I've been out spending a lot of time. I like to campaign. You get out, you talk to voters. I've knocked more than 2,000 doors, and it just confirms for me a lot.
You keep track of that? You keep counting?
We do keep track of it.
Yeah,
yeah, all candidates do. Anybody who tells
you
they don't, they don't.
Like an umpire,
yeah,
right?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Modern technology at work, right?
Exactly,
so I'm a technology executive, and I use software, and it's fun to get out there and see how it works in that environment. But, when I talk to people and I find out kind of what's top of mind for them, it really clarifies for me that there's four things in Greenwich, particularly in the 151st District, that are on people's mind. One is everything around the economy. You know, people are really worried about inflation. They're really worried about affordability, you know, their ability to live here and so on and so forth. And they're really worried about the economic growth in Connecticut. You know, it's a real issue, and I know we'll talk about that in detail. But a lot of the reason people are here is because of they want to raise their families here. And kids and schools. And schools in Greenwich, as always, are performing well, but it's really across the state, education is a real issue. The performance is not great. We have almost half the kids in the state not reading at appropriate grade level in math and in English. So we really have to work on supporting K-12 schools, making them really better. The other thing that's out there is people are concerned about crime. You know, we have a great police force here in Greenwich, and they do a great job of protecting us. But in my district, for example, we're buttoned up right against Stanford. You go talk to people in the wealthiest neighborhoods in Riverside, and they're having cars stolen directly out of their driveways, brazenly in front of actually when they come out and run and try to chase somebody down stealing their cars. So these are issues in crime that we really need to address, and we need to bolster law enforcement. And the last thing that's really on the mind of voters that I'm focusing on and will focus on going to, if I'm fortunate enough to be elected and go to Hartford, is there are many, many mandates that one party up in Hartford have put on the back of Fairfield County communities as it relates to zoning and development. There's some of the craziest bills out there, and I will stand up to any effort they have to turn Greenwich into New Rochelle. They want to build big high-rises. It's a boon to developers, and it's an effort to remove all local control from Greenwich. We know how to run our affairs down here. We don't need the help of Hartford on that. So if I'm fortunate to go up there, I'm going to focus on those four things.
All right. Thanks very much. Next, Representative Kimberly Fiorello. What would you do if elected to another term to address the issues you've talked about?
I definitely brought those up.
Okay. Now, her microphone's not working. All right. So we'll have... Okay, there we go.
All right.
Go right ahead.
My district covers Greenwich and Stamford, and I just love the diversity that brings. And even when it covers Greenwich and Stamford, it's like an interesting swath of Greenwich and Stamford. It's all of backcountry of Greenwich, but then there's a whole section of it that comes all the way down to Byram. And it's the same on the Stamford side with North Stamford and these beautiful shops like La Roca's, little farm stands and farm-to-table restaurants all the way down to Palmer Hill. And we have a whole variety of different kinds of schools in my district, whether it's the Catholic schools to West Hill High and Roxbury and Parkway and Glenville Elementary School. It's a really just beautiful, diverse district. And the issues that we just talked about, they all resonate there as well. Safety, education, the ability to make local decisions. And there's always just a little bit of a twist on the Stamford side, and I love that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Ryan Fazio, tell us your plans to address some of the issues facing the state.
Well, it's a good question, Tony, because it's one thing to complain about how business is done in Hartford, but we also have to offer an alternative in doing so. And so much of this campaign should be focused on the future, the change that we need in the state government in order to create a brighter future for our community down here in southwestern Connecticut. So, for instance, on Monday, I stood with State Representative Fiorello in Stamford and presented a three-step governing platform for the economy in Connecticut. Immediate tax relief across the board to alleviate the pain of inflation for all of our families. Reform the tax system in Connecticut, specifically broaden the base and reduce the income tax rates, which are especially burdensome. And alleviate and streamline many of the regulations. The Cato Institute, for instance, ranks Connecticut as the most costly regulatory burden in the entire country, and that particularly harms small businesses. On zoning and 830G in particular, the state law that allows developers to totally do an end run around local planning and zoning controls, putting up things like 100-unit developments in single-family zone neighborhoods like on Weed Street in New Canaan, which is in my district. At the beginning of this term, I co-introduced legislation with Representatives Aurora and Fiorella to actually fix and change 830G, more local control, give towns a full accounting and credit for the discrete forms of affordable housing that they create, and so on and so forth, down 3, 4, 5 different sections. And then, of course, offering an alternative on public safety, ensure that we have proactive policing. We support local police in order to take illegal guns off the street, reduce the rising shootings and homicides in our state, and harden our criminal justice laws in a reasonable and fair fashion in order to stop the rising car thefts and otherwise the chaos that is rising in some of our most vulnerable neighborhoods. There is a better way, and it's not enough to just complain or criticize one alternative. It's very important to provide new leadership and try to bring people together under that umbrella.
All right, thanks, Senator Fazio. We'll go to the next question, back to Ed Lopez, and talk about the economy. And there seems to be a debate over how's the economy doing. Some say doing well, others not so good. Big surplus, not big surplus.
Sure.
Do you believe what's happening, and what are your thoughts about the economy?
Well, I think when I go door to door, what I hear from people is that the economic circumstances are definitely putting a pinch in their ability to pay bills and to do a lot of things. I have a very diverse district. We know that Byram and Chickahominy and some parts of downtown are very different from parts of Old Greenwich and Riverside. But at the end of the day, everybody is concerned about how the money they work for is spent by the government. And that's one of the big concerns that I hear. When you look at the circumstances we're dealing with, you have to consider, for example, do the people feel they're spending more money to pay their bills or to get gas or to buy groceries? You have to consider how much Uncle Sam and the state is keeping from what they earn. You have to look at how many of your neighbors, friends, and relatives have moved to other states. You have to consider what's different about the circumstances that you've been exposed to here in Connecticut as opposed to the ones that you have now. So I think that the what you're seeing is evidence of how people are being harmed by the current economic circumstances here in the state. When you consider, for example, the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis showing that Connecticut's economy declined 4.7% in the second quarter this year, meaning April through June, and you look at things like the growth rate being the second worst nationally, the 300-plus layoffs by M&T Bank, Stanley Black & Decker reducing 1,000 jobs, Raytheon moving and following the path of GE. When you take all these things into account, you know that something's hurting our families here in Greenwich and in the state, and we have to go to Hartford and do something about it. We've had many years of the same leadership and the majority party, and I think it's good to have a dialogue where we're debating things and thinking about new approaches, like Ryan said.
All right. Thanks, Ed. Peter Scherer, give us your thoughts about the economy. How's it doing? If it's not doing so well, what's the evidence supporting that?
The Connecticut economy is not good. I mean, I know that sounds really negative, and I don't like to think negative thoughts, but the economy in Connecticut has been stagnant and lagging the rest of the nation for a really long time. I mean, Ed was talking about some statistics. The second quarter numbers were terrible, down 4-plus percent. that's a shrinking economy. That's a full-blown, pretty strong recession. There's a debate about the first quarter numbers. You know, the Hearst newspapers are trying to spin that as the numbers aren't valid. It doesn't matter what the numbers are. They're not good. Personal income in its second quarter was down 2.2%. You know, we're in a full-blown recession in Connecticut. And we're all watching these political ads online, and, you know, politicians will say what they say, we've cut taxes, we've shrunk the deficit, you know, all these things. That's what I expect. But the numbers speak otherwise. To Ed's point, you know, when I came to Connecticut, got my first job out of college, I came to Stanford. I was fortunate enough to be hired by IBM. I worked down in Harbor Plaza. It was a fully occupied place. There were 10-plus Fortune 500 companies based in Stanford. It was a thriving state. We were the place, the mecca, where large corporations moved their headquarters. And those are, like, really valuable jobs. That's no longer the case. I mean, Massachusetts, as an example, has a much better tax structure. It used to be called Taxachusetts. I don't know what you call it, Connecticut now. Up in Massachusetts, they were able to lure away General Electric, that had been in Bridgeport for I don't know how many years, and United Technologies out of Hartford. I mean, you just think about that. I mean, that's like taking, I don't know, our biggest diamond and our biggest sapphire. And it's because of the environment that's been created that just isn't business friendly. But we really need to address this. I agree that completely we need to redo our tax structure, particularly as it relates to the income tax. We have to flatten the income tax. We have to lower the rates. We may have to tighten our belt in the state budget to do that, but that's the important thing to do. The other thing that we need to do up in Hartford is we need to eliminate, people don't know this, but there are 200 taxes on the tax register that are collected in Connecticut that generate 0.22% of revenue in the state. I would venture to say we're probably spending more money collecting those taxes than we're actually getting out of them. But all of the businesses that are here, and I've started two companies in Connecticut. It's not the most friendly business state, and there's a lot of regulatory work you have to deal with. There's a lot of compliance work, a lot of paperwork. We need to unshackle businesses. We need to restore Connecticut to the incredible business-friendly state that it used to be that caused this state to boom before one-party rule came in Hartford. So it's a serious issue. It has to be our top issue in the next legislative session.
Okay, we're going to go next to Senator Ryan Fazio. Tell us your thoughts about the economy and what to do.
Listen, the statistics that my colleague cited are absolutely correct, but so are the anecdotes that we hear when we talk to small business owners and middle-class families when we're out campaigning, when we're knocking on doors. When I stood, along with Representative Fiorello, with small business owners from the three towns I represent on Monday to talk about the economic release from the federal government about Connecticut, they confirm exactly those numbers, but they personalize it. One restaurateur here in Greenwich says that she thinks about shutting down business because it's so hard to operate constantly in Connecticut. But then she thinks of her employees and wants them to be able to get by. The local energy company, which provides energy, especially home heating, says that they continue to take margin cuts, significant margin cuts, because of the rising costs. But they still stay in business and still deliver vital goods and services to people. The tech company founder that I talked to in Stanford, who says that it would be much more profitable for him to move his company to a different state, except he loves Stanford, he loves his community, and he wants to stay here and operate. It's just becoming increasingly difficult for these people to create jobs and for middle class and working class people to afford to live here. And that's, I think, the greatest shame in the world, because this is such a great community. I think it's the most amazing state in the most amazing country in the world. If you just look at it on paper, on its face, we have the third highest rate of bachelor's degrees in the entire country. We sit between two great cities. We have a beautiful state with a shoreline and beautiful greenery and rolling hills from corner to corner of the state. Governing this state, from my point of view, should be the easiest job in the world. There is no reason that our economy should not be succeeding fantastically if only we have the right leadership. And so, again, this is not just about assessing the state of things here in Connecticut or providing a progress report to the people who are in charge. It's about providing new leadership in a better way. And we can do that by encouraging job creation, by reducing cost of living, by supporting small businesses, by reducing the marginal income tax rates and retirement taxes. There is a better way. I think Connecticut's economy can succeed fabulously if only we have a change in direction from Hartford.
All right, Senator Fazio, Representative Fiorillo, your thoughts about the state economy and what to do.
It's so true that it's there is a better way, and it's been so tried and true throughout human history. I mean, the freedom actually works. And to let go of the economy, let go of all the constraints, and let people try and succeed and fail and succeed. I mean, that kind of creative energy is what we need to bring to Connecticut. But what you do feel is that there is definitely a sense that the government is overburdening the people of Connecticut. We talked about businesses leaving to Massachusetts. And Massachusetts, what we call Taxachusetts, has a flat tax rate of 5%. And Connecticut has seven tax brackets from 3 up to 6.99%. And our income taxes aren't they're not bracketed to inflation. And so as inflation impacts us, people, it's called a bracket creep, and people are finding themselves, you know, being pushed up into higher income tax brackets. There's a lot of what I find is there's always a desire up there in Hartford to have these huge omnibus bills. And for example, the budget bill, it came at 4 a.m. It was 790 plus pages. And it's touted as a historic tax cut. But do people really feel like they got a historic tax cut? Sometimes economics and understanding state budget seems like it's over our heads. And you read the news and they talk about billion-dollar surpluses. But so often you just have to trust what you're seeing and experiencing in your own life. If you find that you're going to the grocery store and a $100 grocery bill is only filling half of your brown bag, or that, you know, the latest notice from the water from Aquarian has you feeling stressed that suddenly water is going to be doubled, or you're going to have to, I don't know, tell your children only take one quick shower. Or the fact that heating oil, I mean, as we go towards a winter coming, so much of, I feel regular people just need to rely on the realities that they're facing and not let themselves be misguided by big words like government surplus. The truth is, if our government really had a genuine surplus and it was a real balanced budget, then the money would be returned to the people, because the surplus means the government took too much, much more than it needed. But our governor will not be returning that money to the people because he knows he faces a fiscal cliff and he needs to hold on to those billions of dollars. Most people know the solution to our economy. It's to cut taxes. It's to reduce regulations, to reduce red tape. And that is about letting people keep more of their own money. It's about letting people have more of their time and energy and resources returned to them so that they can manage and solve their daily lives. And when that happens, it is a beautiful flourishing of humans and families and businesses and nonprofits. I mean, everything flourishes in that kind of limited government, trust in regular people. And that can happen in Connecticut. We just have to choose it. And there's a party that's offering it, the Republicans.
All right, thanks, Representative Kimberly Fiorillo. We are going to take a break in our legislative forum. And back in our legislative forum here on AM 1490, FM 105.5, WGCH, WGCH.com, anywhere. I'm Tony Savino with the Republican candidates for House and Senate. We've got incumbent Republican Senator Ryan Fazio, incumbent State Representative Kimberly Fiorello, Ed Lopez, Republican challenging Stephen Meskers in the 150th House, and Peter Scheer, who is running against Hector Arzino for the open seat in the 151st House. So we're going to go now to Ed Lopez in the 150th and go from the economy to education. A lot of talk now about the role of parents in schools. Some candidates calling for a parents' bill of rights. Do you feel this is needed in Connecticut? Your thought on the education, the status of education in the state?
I'm the son of educators. My parents were both college professors, and my family's always had a big investment in academic pursuits. We really believe in having a big focus on that as a family. My mother's actually an ESL for adults teacher here in the Greenwich school system, and we've been in a lot of places pursuing these goals in education. So for me, education is a big issue, and I think that what we're looking at is parents are taxpayers, and so it matters to them how these tax dollars are being spent. I think they should have a voice in the schools, and it should be a dialogue with the teachers as well. I think that a lot of times the temperature goes up very quickly when it comes to these issues where it's one side and the other. I think we have to find a way to work collaboratively. But part of that is recognizing that those who are paying tax dollars and have children these schools need to have a voice in them too. And so I think it's absolutely important to have that dialogue and try to understand how those of us who live in these communities can best resolve and determine what we can do to improve education for our children.
All right. Thanks, Ed. Peter Scheer, your thoughts on the status of education in Connecticut and the Parents' Bill of Rights?
Yeah, Tony, I mean, that's such a huge question. I spent 12 years on the Greenwich Board of Education, so I've become deeply immersed in everything education policy. And I always come at it from the perspective of the parents representing children. That's always been my orientation because when you're on the board and you're elected to a board of education, I think that's who you really represent. You know, schools have always worked well when there was a strong balance, a compact between teachers, administrators, and parents. And when that's in balance, and parents are truly partners with teachers, or teachers are really partners with parents in the education of their children, it works really well. The first 8 years I was on the Board of Education here in Greenwich, that was always in balance. It worked. The administrators understood, successive superintendents, teachers, principals, they understood what the values were and how much in Greenwich parents really value education. It's one of the main reasons they move to the community. Unfortunately, and I watched it in the final 4 years I was on the Board of Education, that really changed. Administrators started pushing their own agenda. The teacher union started pushing their own agenda. I can remember when the Greenwich teacher union president said in a board meeting, and it was kind of a slip of the tongue. She said, we get your kids for a couple hours and we get them and we have to fix them and then we hand them back to you, as if parents were doing damage to children and it was their mission to, quote, fix children. That always troubled me when she said that. And then it culminated in what we see now, which is not enough focus on academics, a lot of focus on our social issues and pushing those in. And unfortunately, that is becoming a wedge between parents and educators. There are so many teachers in Greenwich who know where those limits and boundaries are. Unfortunately, we have a superintendent here in Greenwich who's been pushing a strong political and social agenda into schools. It's creating a lot of tension. But this is also emanating from Hartford. That's one of the reasons I'm running, is when you realize how much is coming out of Hartford that are mandates in these areas down to districts. Districts really need to have the autonomy to run locally, but they don't, increasingly with Hartford. Hartford's sending down mandates on highly politicized curriculum. They're sending down mandates on highly sexualized. It's just not helpful. And when you look at the results, we need more time on academics and less on that. What we do need to do is bring it back into balance, to your question of parents. Curriculum needs to be transparent to parents. Parents need to be notified when there are issues with their children in school, whatever it may be, a mental health issue. You may not be aware of this, but schools are allowed to provide mental health services to children without notifying parents. That's the law in Connecticut. I don't think it happens very much in Greenwich, but that's the actual law in Connecticut. There are things about children's sexuality that parents don't need to be aware of. These kinds of tensions with people with an agenda in Hartford are pushing into schools lead to a reaction naturally from parents where they want a codified Bill of Rights. Teachers have a Bill of Rights, essentially. It's called a code of conduct that's in law. Parents don't have that. It would be unfortunate if that's what's happened. But if that's what's needed to bring us back into balance, I will strongly support some kind of parental Bill of Rights if it comes up in the next session.
All right. Thank you, Representative Fiorello. I think your microphone might be working, actually. Don't move it too much, though.
Is it?
It is working. Go okay. Right ahead. Give us your thoughts about the status of education and Parents' Bill of Rights.
Yeah. Well, parents are the primary decision makers for their children. Is that a controversial thing to say? I really hope that that's... It's funny to even have to say it, but it is something that we have to state, and that would be the basis of a Parental Bill of Rights, is that parents are the primary decision makers for their children. Maybe we should say that like several more times. But when I got up to Hartford, I was really stunned when I learned that there are some areas of healthcare where there's no parental notification or parental consent required. And the areas are, and these are for minors, anyone under 16, treatment of drug or alcohol abuse, no parental notification or consent required. 6 mental health treatments. I thought that was strange when I read this. Why just 6? And then testing for HIV, reproductive health services that includes abortions, and then treatment for STDs, venereal diseases. And so, okay, that's interesting that that's the premise. But what triggered this is that before me was a bill to say that we will now go unlimited for mental health treatments without parental notification. I mean, think about that. We're saying in the state of Connecticut that your child can have unlimited. Somewhere, at some point, some legislators said, well, that's, we should say at least 6. So the 7th one, the parents sort of get pulled into the conversation. But no, this current legislature in 2021 said, no, it's going to be unlimited. And I was shocked because the premise of that is that the parents are the problem and will stay the problem and the parents stay in the dark the whole time. What followed after that was a bill on insurance. And this one was very curious because it allowed the minor to have the explanation of benefit, which is like the bill for the healthcare service provided, to be redirected to a different email or different mailing address. And so I read that bill, and I remember asking the proponent, how does a child know, even a teenager, how does a minor know what an EOB is? And what address or email are they sending it to? And why? But that bill passed. That's a bill I said no to. And then the following year, 2022, you know, after we had shut down the schools for our children and, you know, our society went into lockdown, and we really, you know, mental health was on our lips for all of us. And I would say the Reagan, you know, most dangerous 11 words, be careful when your government comes knocking and they're there to help you, is the government responded. Hartford said mental health is a top issue, and there were massive omnibus bills that came before us. And I want to share with your listeners that parental rights alarm bells went off for me on SB1, which is, it says, it's got a great sounding name. That's the other thing. All these bills have good names. An Act Concerning Childhood Mental and Physical Health Services. And this bill did 3 things. It provides funding to hire more social workers, school psychologists, counselors, and nurses into the schools. It does a second thing that creates a study for a special permit to allow clinical and medical professionals to provide their services to students in schools. And then three, it provides state money to open more school-based health centers, which will include the mental health professionals I mentioned before, as well as dentists, eye doctors, and physicians. So for me, many of us want to see our schools focused on academics, academic excellence. You know, we have to compete not only with other states, but with the world. We want the children in Connecticut, Greenwich, and Stamford to be competitive as writers and to be able to read all great books and compete in math and science. And our schools are kind of taking an interesting turn. I'm sure there are benefits and good things, but we have to be very vigilant and watch what's happening in your schools as they introduce a lot more health services and mental health services, which we now know in Connecticut can happen without parental notification and as many services as needed. As many as needed is the language in the bill. So, you know, that's kind of a very specific story about the lack of parental rights in our state. And I do feel that a parental rights bill is needed.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Fiorello. And Senator Fazio, your thoughts.
Tony, I grew up in this district, in this town. I'm a product of the public schools. I know that we love our public schools. We love our teachers. And some of the incidents we've seen in the past couple of years of inappropriate curriculum, and certainly in the video of the assistant principal in Coscob School, I think was a great offense to all of our families, all of our great teachers, everyone across town. We all want, the vast majority of our town, of my district, wants great schools, parental input, and a appropriate and strong core curriculum. So we not only need leadership from the local level to ensure that, but we also need the right leadership at the state level. We don't want state control of our local public schools and the involvement that a state has in its public school system generally should be the right type to ensure academic excellence across the board and transparency. So when I entered the legislature this term, I tried to submit as many pieces of legislation that I thought have broad appeal across the public. Transparency in our curriculum. I submitted a bill for that that said that there's no reason that all parents, all the entire public, shouldn't be able to easily access curriculum and course material that's presented in public schools online. They are public after all, and they do answer to parents and the general public. We should have a core curriculum that's focused on reading, writing, and arithmetic and history and civics. There's a study a few years back from the Woodrow Wilson Institute that found that while most Americans above the age of 65 could pass a citizenship test, that fewer than 20% of younger Americans, young adults in this country, could. We're no longer teaching the basic facts about our nation's history and our nation's government, which is deeply troubling. And it's important, especially because public schools need to, and all schools need to, help forge good citizens who are ready to engage our democracy and be leaders later in life. So I introduced a requirement that says that in civics courses in high schools that all students should be able to pass a citizenship exam. So we know that they're learning the right things, the true facts about our nation and our nation's history, rather than narratives that, shall we say, are not appropriate. And then we should also ensure that we have the highest caliber of academics in our schools. I introduced legislation that starts to go down the path of exploring what Massachusetts did in the 1990s in its public school system. Massachusetts probably has the best public schools in the entire country after engaging in that that education reform agenda in the 1990s. Governor Bill Weld was in office at the time. And since then, Massachusetts, despite spending $2,000 or $3,000 less per pupil than Connecticut and having very similar demographics, has been ranked pretty consistently number one in reading and mathematical testing for grades 3 and 8, which is the only state since they've had that testing that's been able to do so. So great schools, parental input, and a rigorous, appropriate core curriculum should be the basis that I think all people can rally around for our education system.
All right, that's State Senator Ryan Fazio. As we close in on the 7 o'clock hour, we're going to have news at the top of the hour. Then we're going to come back another hour of our legislative forum as we have the candidates for House and Senate. Republican Ed Lopez in the 150th House, who is challenging Democratic incumbent Stephen Meskers in the 151st. It's an open seat with Harry Arore, the incumbent running for state treasurer. So Peter Scheer, the Republican candidate, is here. He is going up against the Democrat Hector Arzino. In the 149th House, Republican Kimberly Fiorello is here. She's being challenged by Democrat Rachel Khanna. And in the 36th State Senate, incumbent Ryan Fazio running against, being challenged by Democrat Trevor Crow. So we're going to take a break. We will be back with the news and then more of a legislative forum here on AM 1490, FM 105.5, WGCH and WGCH.com anywhere.
Tina Broccoli is an image consultant, personal shopper, and wardrobe organizer. She will assist you in identifying your ideal look and style and the statement you want to make to those around you. But it's not magic. The image really comes from within you. Tina just helps to bring it out. Visit stylebytina.com. That's stylebytina.com. Tina will assess and evaluate your overall appearance and determine how best to achieve a look that will...
Number two of our legislative forum here on AM 1490, FM 105.5, WGCH and WGCH.com. Anywhere, I'm Tony Savino. One more hour with the candidates for office. This is the 149th House seat. It's Republican incumbent Kimberly Fiorello. In the 150th House, it's Republican Ed Lopez, a challenger to incumbent Stephen Meskers. In the 151st House seat, it's an open seat. Peter Scheer, Republican, is here. And in this 36th Senate seat, it's incumbent Republican Ryan Fazio. So next question, we'll start again with Ed Lopez, is going to be about police and crime. Police department down 15 officers. Stanford's down, I guess, the great resignation taking place in the police department. Anyway, what can be done about this? Why do you think it's happening? What can be done to fix it?
Well, I think we have to revisit the Police Accountability Act, which I think affected a lot of the perspective on what it's going to take to become a police officer and the things that you're going to be liable for. I'm a sergeant in the U.S. Army National Guard, and I work with a lot of police officers that are also in the National Guard. My family's had law enforcement personnel, too, in Dallas, Fort Worth, and also in New York, in New York City. And so I understand the sensitivities that this bill strikes in a lot of these folks. When we talk about politics, we try to radicalize a lot of things and try to push things to the extremes, you know, the left and the right. This is a bill that I think was, in fact, very radical. And I think it was what drove that radicalism in a way was, it wasn't necessarily bad intentions. You know, I'm sensitive to civil liberties. I tend to be a very libertarian-leaning Republican. And I think things like the Fourth Amendment have to be considered carefully, for example. But I also think that we have to understand a lot of police officers, the majority of them, are doing their jobs well. What we're doing with the Police Accountability Bill is making them, putting them at risk. You know, when we keep them from being able to acquire certain military gear, for example, night vision stuff, body armor, things like that, that could make their jobs easier, we're putting them at risk. I also feel very strongly that police officers need to integrate better into their community. So it goes both ways, but I think the accountability bill, what it did in a lot of ways, is it just put so much liability on police officers. I think we have to go back, revisit that, fix the issues with that bill, and certainly have a discussion about how to make things, the job safer for police officers. We have a great police department in Greenwich, And I feel like as far as recruiting people, removing these barriers, these concerns that these young people have, is one paramount thing. But I also feel like another thing we have to help young applicants understand is that we offer some great benefits. We offer great things. I think the Greenwich Police Department is one of the most rewarding places for anybody who wants to go into that field. And I'm all for being a good cheerleader for that. So that's what I think.
All right. Thanks, Ed. Peter Scheer, your thoughts about the... about police accountability, the police departments, and trying to get no more police.
Yeah, I'm concerned. This is such a sensitive topic for so many people, particularly people who are victims of crime. And I recognize there are some people who may, somewhere along the way, not been treated properly by criminal justice. But I think by law enforcement, I think these are very isolated, particularly in our district. I'm running to represent the people of the 151st District. I'm not running to represent everyone in Connecticut, and I'm not running to represent people in other states. I'm very focused on what the role is. And I'm concerned, Tony, you raised some issues. I think, you know, defund police and the social justice reforms that were movements in the past few years that have been translated into policy in state legislatures, particularly in Connecticut and Hartford, they haven't worked. And we've seen the unintended consequences, or maybe consequences people we could have foreseen, and what happened. The one statistic that really bothers me as an example is, that you didn't reference, is the state's down 360. Let's just let that sink in for a minute. 360 trooper positions. So, and towns can't recruit. So if the state can't recruit because the pool of employees isn't big enough, towns can't compete because they're in the same pool competing for talent. You know, we have to be pulling the fire alarm to realize that something has to change. I think there are a number of things we can do. One is we have to restore qualified immunity for police officers. It was an interesting idea out of Hartford, but it was very misguided as policy. I think it's just a set of people who had an axe to grind, and it really did a job on our law enforcement community. And we need to make that a high priority to fix that. I think the other thing we should do, which is particularly an issue in the 151st District, is we need to enhance penalties for crimes committed using a stolen vehicle. We have so many car thefts on the eastern side of town, particularly in my district and in Ed's district. You know, if we're up there as representatives, we have to be doing things at the state level that will help solve that problem. I think the other thing we have to recognize is, look, it's hard to be a police officer. It's a hard job, and we need to support police officers as well as we can. And that means, in some cases, giving them the mental health services that they need, particularly from getting them on the job. And that may mean workers' compensation reforms, other insurance reforms. But we have to recognize that these are the ways that we have to support our police officers. There are other things, you know, people will talk about victims, I'm sure, and victims' advocacy. So we're not out of balance with criminals versus the rights of criminals versus the rights of victims. But I also take from a school perspective. I am very troubled and have been troubled for a while. Ryan talked about curriculum and curriculum transparency. That an anti-police bias in curriculum has crept into what our children are learning and hearing in schools every day. And that's what I talked about before. When these things get out of balance, people have an agenda, they push them into the curriculum. It just creates a lot of tension in the system. It's completely unnecessary. And I would like to see us, particularly if I were up there focusing on the education component, I'd like to ban anti-police teaching of any kind, particularly in elementary schools. And that would be something I would focus on. We really need to solve this problem. We need to come back and look at policing again. And we need to do a much better job of supporting our law enforcement community who keep us safe every day in our neighborhoods.
All right. Thank you, Peter Scheer, Representative Fiorillo.
There's so many great comments made by Ed and Peter. Let me see what I can add. I'll say power and crime is real in bad bills. So a lot of power.
You were there and seeing it, so you had a ringside seat to the craziness that went on up there.
Indeed. There's a lot of power and trust that's given to police officers. You know, their job is to enforce our laws, and the word enforce includes the word force. And so we need the best among us to go into this profession. They have to have, you know, just a really strong moral fiber. They have to know and exercise self-restraint. And we need them to be, you know, book smart and street smart. And then, you know, to go through all the training, whether there are men and women who have this calling to serve. And what you point out in this question, Tony, is that people don't want to do this profession anymore. Even if they have the calling, their rational, logical mind is telling them to choose something else. And that is a problem. Two, I said crime is real. I had a chance to visit police officers in Bridgeport And they took me to this room. It was filled with cameras and screens. And these were detectives that were solving crime. They were solving crime of car thefts. And it was just fascinating to see them. And so they showed me video of the kinds of crimes they're seeing, just the blatant attacks on police. They just ram their cars into the police cars. There's shootings that happen, but just a real brazenness that I was stunned to see with my own eyes, and then to realize that these officers see that every day when they get up to go to work. They have no idea what they're going to encounter, and what they do encounter is terrifying for the average citizen. So the good news in the fact that crime is real is that we have great people still in our department solving these crimes and coming to work every day. And then the third point I wanted to make was bad bills. Just in my short term, you know, just I'm a freshman. I've only been there 2 years in Hartford. They passed the police accountability bill before I got up there. And as I was running and reading that bill and talking to subject matter experts before I was a legislator, I was just, you know, so bothered that a room full of politicians were trying to prescribe the work of police officers as if they fully understood it. And since I've been up there on the Judiciary Committee as one of the few non-attorneys asking basic questions, is there has been so much time and effort by legislators gone into fixing the stuff that got a little screwy under the police accountability bill. I mean, what a waste of time and effort. But they weren't done. After that, we passed an automatic erasure bill that created a process by which felony records are automatically erased. This bypasses an existing process by which people who feel like they've reformed their lives can go through an existing process. And that includes forgiveness from the victims. But now that has been bypassed with automatic erasure. Then we passed recreational marijuana. And that, and part of that bill said police officers cannot stop vehicles with drivers or passengers who are obviously inhaling or ingesting cannabis. That's not safe. That does not keep us safe on the roads. We also passed anti-solitary confinement. And that's a bill that's premised that our corrections officers, you know, treat the incarcerated inhumanely. On the docket coming up, it didn't pass this time, but we know they want to do it, is a deceptive and anti-deceptive interrogations bill. And many detectives were very concerned about this bill because, you know, this is politicians micromanaging how detectives do their work. So I'm concerned that we need good people to go into these very important professions. Law enforcement is one of the number one roles, proper roles of government. And crime is real. We have good people still there, but we still need good folks to join the ranks. And I'm concerned about the bad bills that have passed since the police accountability and the more bad bills that are on the docket.
All right. Thanks, Representative Fiorillo. Senator Fazio.
Like some of my colleagues, I'm very proud to be endorsed by the Fraternal Order Police and the Stamford Police Association, and I'm also proud to have been endorsed by other local police organizations in my previous runs. And part of the reason is because I know so many of our local officers in New Canaan and in Stamford and in Greenwich, and I know what good people they are, and I know how much they love the communities that they serve. Many of them have deep roots in these communities as well. And so what the state government has done to undermine police and policing in recent years and also undermine the public safety, I think is deeply regrettable, is unforgivable. And I think there needs to be change in our state government to reverse the mistakes that have been made in recent years. First, in order to reduce the mandates and costs and risks that have been imposed by the state on local police departments. I think our local police departments do a great job, but all the costly mandates, including the mandates that were imposed on local departments in the police accountability bill, reduced the resources available to pay and recruit officers, which are the most important way that we keep people safe, with good personnel and good officers. And when I talked to the police chiefs, including Chief Heavey, you know, he says that when he was a entry-level officer, that there was 100 people applying for 20 spots, and now there's, you know, 20 or 5 or 30 people applying for 20 spots or some sort of ratio like that. So we need the resources to have, we need flexibility in the resources locally. Also reduce the risk that are imposed upon local departments or police officers. Every police officer in the state knows about removing of qualified immunity. It's at the tip of the tongue of every single police officer maybe I've ever spoken to in this state, no matter what town or city they're from. They get it. They know which side the state capitol is on, and it's not on their side anymore. We need to improve the safety of police officers. There's a police officer from upstate whose wife I had on one of my public safety forums in New Canaan, whose husband was nearly killed by a fleeing criminal who had stolen a vehicle. I think it was in Torrington. And these officers understand that their hands are tied on the job. Use of force has become extremely restrictive. So now the standard essentially for evaluating use of force on the job is sort of like a retrospective objective standard rather than a reasonable at the time standard, which inhibits police from doing their job and also puts them at greater risk of their own safety. The duty to intervene in the police accountability bill also does that. So those two changes to use of force policy put our officers at risk and inhibit them from doing their job well. And finally, we need to reestablish a culture of respect towards law enforcement and local police. It should be lost on no one. Let's stay away from the policy for a moment. It should be lost on no one that the most powerful people and politicians in our state went around the state 2 years ago, went around even this region 2 years ago, saying that policing per se was unjust and biased and part of the problem. Well, it's no surprise that the reaction among criminals was that they were galvanized. And that has resulted in more victims. That has resulted in more police who have been victims on the job. So we need leadership in this state who is not going to bend to the whims of whatever cultural phenomenon is most recent and say that we love our local police. There are bad actors and they should be held accountable, but we love our local police and we believe in a culture of rule of law and public safety. And so we're going to stand up for that, not only in our laws, but in our culture.
All right, so Senator Ryan Fazio. Before we get to the next question, I do want to thank Sam Romeo, who's usually heard at this time with his show Greenwich Matters. Sam will be on next week from 6 to 8 on Thursday night. All right, also on the crime front, a suit to pull back on Connecticut's gun safety laws. Do you believe this is a good idea or a bad idea, and why? And also, where do you stand on new gun-related legislation? Ed Lopez.
I think this ties back to the Police Accountability Act in a lot of ways. Ultimately, if we're not equipping our police officers to police illegal firearms, we get into a lot of the issues that we have. And we have a lot of debates about whether crime is up or down in Connecticut. As of last year, over the course of 10 years, the state averaged 112 murders or manslaughters a year. And I think for people who are victims of this, the families that suffer from this, these are things that in reality, the statistics, the data points, whether it's up or down, it's still going to matter a lot. And so reinforcing our police officers' ability to act and to patrol and to serve us is an important thing. When it comes to guns, as a National Guard member, I understand the lethality of firearms, and I understand the importance of addressing illegal firearms. I feel that at the end of the day, I support the constitutional right to bear arms. But I also understand that our rights in that space come with some restraints, and I think that it's always worth looking at our laws and understanding where we're at with them, and we have to take it in the context that we're in. I think the important thing to remember, too, is, for example, we had a Supreme Court decision that affected the laws in New York recently. So we always have to be ready to understand what might be coming our way as a state and understand how it's going to affect our rights as citizens, but also relative to the people who are enforcing the law and keeping illegal firearms off the street.
All right, thanks. Ed Lopez, Peter Scheer.
You know, I have a different perspective on guns. I grew up as a small kid going to camp. Back then, you used to learn the use of firearms and firearm safety on a rifle range, as an example. I'm old enough that that was a typical thing that was in camp. I haven't particularly owned firearms in my life, but I've always been highly sensitive to the lethality of them, as Ed said, and the need to really respect firearms. So I've always thought about that from the beginning. But I had a unique also perspective because I was relatively new to the Board of Education when Newtown happened. And that was just, for me personally, it was devastating. Particularly because at that time I was really focused on kids and I was focused on schools and how great and wonderful that can be. And the whole idea of, you know, supporting our children and our youth. I mean, that's one of the most important things a society can do. And that was just unbelievable. It was so shocking at the time. And my heart broke, as I know many people did, for those parents. And I can't imagine what they lived through after that. And I understand that they turned their sorrow into advocacy. And we really have to commend parents, anyone who will do that and what have you. I became really also very curious about the application of our gun laws and gun licensing in Connecticut. So recently, because I'm a guy who typically does my homework, I don't just go for the soundbite. So I recently went through and tried to get a gun license just for the purpose of seeing how it actually worked in Connecticut. And we have very strong gun licensing laws, ammunition licensing laws in Connecticut. And it was very interesting to me to see how that whole process worked. And I think there are a lot of protections in the system. What I think has to happen, though, which is the most important part, is we need to bolster those laws, as an example, particularly if children and children have access to guns. And every gun owner I know had a similar experience of learning early about guns. And they know how to protect the guns, keep them out of hands, don't make them accessible to children, so on and so forth. I don't think that's the most important issue. What is a really important issue, which scares me to death, is, look, the murder rate in Connecticut is up nationally. It goes back to what kind of society do we want to have? What kind of strong economy do we want to have? You're not going to have economic growth and attract businesses if your cities have crime waves in them. And Kim was talking about that, about what's happening in Bridgeport, what's happening in Hartford, what's happening in New Haven. This directly ties to crime. And I think the most important thing we can focus on with firearms is to bolster the police to get illegal firearms out of the hands of people who should not have them. And get those illegal firearms off the street. We get a lot of benefit out of that. We protect our schools and we protect our communities by doing that. We protect law enforcement, tell them we're backing them up doing that. We protect our children. It just, that needs to be our focus. And if we can accomplish that, I think we'll really deal with the issue of guns and the impact that it's having in our Connecticut society.
All right, thank you, Peter Scherer, Representative Fiorillo.
I had a personal experience with guns when I was a cadet at West Point. Before that, as you know, the daughter of Korean immigrants, I would never have had any experience with that. But I did learn, you know, how to respect firearms, and I learned all the, you know, ways to treat it and use it and clean it and respect it. In fact, at West Point, they assign a rifle to the cadet and you sleep with it. But gun safety is extremely important, and nobody knows that better than the quarter of our population of lawful gun owners in Connecticut. In regards to the lawsuit, if a law doesn't accord to the Second Amendment, and it violates the Constitution, and the courts say so, I think we have to read that opinion and learn from there. I'm eagerly waiting to see what happens with that lawsuit as well. And I have a profound respect for our Constitution and the ways to amend the Constitution if we as a society want to, whether it's the state or the federal. Thank you.
Representative Fiorillo, Senator Fazio.
Yeah, I think my colleagues make thoughtful points. I think that we as a state can and should be able to protect people's constitutional rights, take illegal guns off the street at the hands of criminals, and protect the public safety all at once. Connecticut has very strict gun laws, generally speaking. I don't foresee that changing. But we've also taken away the tools from police necessary to actually take illegal guns off the street, to enforce the most valuable gun laws that we have on the books. And, you know, it goes back to the previous conversation we had about the police accountability bill, which eliminated consent searches, which are clearly things that a tactic that respect people's civil liberties because they require consent of a person's search. But police departments across Connecticut said that those proactive policing tactics were responsible for taking hundreds of illegal guns off the street. And it's no surprise to me that since passing the police accountability bill and taking away some of the tools from law enforcement from taking illegal guns off the street, that we've seen shootings skyrocket, especially in our cities across this state. We've seen a 35% increase in homicides over the last 2 years across Connecticut. I mean, that's unacceptable to me. But that's with the laws on the books, but without us enforcing the most important laws that we have. So this is a clearly fixable problem, like a lot of the crime and law enforcement problems that our state is facing, and a self-induced wound, very much so. I think we can right the ship. We can protect the public safety. We can reduce shootings. And I should also say that that we should also stop any of the radicalism in the state capitol to take away protection from our schools. School resource officers are a very valuable element of our school community, and they serve as a last resort to protecting kids in worst case scenario. But the senator in charge of the Senate Judiciary Committee has a bill on the docket to try to eliminate school resource officers statewide. And I don't think that's right, and I don't think that would protect the public safety, especially of our most vulnerable citizens. So I think there's clear common sense answers here.
All right, thank you, Senator Fazio. We're going to take another break. This is the Greenwich Legislative Forum, H.com Anywhere. I'm Tony Savino. This is our Legislative Forum, and we continue. We'll be here until 8 o'clock tonight with the forum, and we're going to go now to local control, 830G, zoning. We're going to go to first State Representative Kimberly Fiorello. Any thoughts about that, Representative?
Oh, what a storm we had on these zoning bills. When I got onto planning and development, which I had specifically requested when I won the election, because I knew that there were these big zoning bills coming into planning and development, but I had no idea how incredibly comprehensive this attack on local control or home rule was going to be. And it was relentless in the first term. I think we had 13 different bills. They were bills from anywhere from expanding the jurisdiction of housing authorities so that they could go and build in beyond their own, beyond the towns that they are in charge of, to fair share housing, which was a very complicated bill with many more percentage requirements and ratios that towns would have to meet. But it also opened up the towns to much more litigation as different groups would be allowed to, claim that they are good plaintiffs to transit-oriented development, which allowed as-of-right building in some of the most historic areas of our towns. And this was all on the backdrop of a state that is old. Many of our towns are almost 100%. We have towns with 100% septic. They don't have town water. It's all on well water. They don't have town sewers. In fact, even in Greenwich, I live right next to the library, and I'm about where the town water ends. And so, you know, this incredible push for density in the guise of affordable housing was a whirlwind of confusion for the lawmakers who were trying to understand these bills and the citizens. But a massive kudos, a real huge kudos to the people of Connecticut, because they rose to this occasion. Those who volunteer on zoning commissions, anybody who had experience with land use, they read these bills. They rallied behind a Facebook page called CT169 Strong, and they put out detailed information about each of these bills, and they responded. And truly, it was like government of the people, by the people, for the people in action, because they were asserting that you guys in Hartford work for us, not the other way around. What we found is that a lot of these bills that were coming from organizations were organized, and they had money behind it. And there was, you know, an agenda that was beyond what was the real movement of the people of Connecticut, which really was grassroots versus corporate lobbyists on the other side pushing for the right to ignore local zoning so that they can build under the guise of affordable housing. But when you looked at these bills, they really did not address affordable housing. So it's a real victory, Tony. It's a victory for the people of Connecticut that we protected local decision making. That is the most democratic thing. You know, these zoning commissions, they're volunteers. Some are elected, some are appointed. But that's democracy. You want to change how zoning is done, then get on your local zoning board. But to put together, you know, an expensive lobby group with all these academics, and it was incredible. But going forward, that fight is not finished. They will continue to come after 1 acre single family zoning. And to me, this is an attack on the middle class. It's the broad middle class who own their homes. There is such a beautiful sense of freedom and self-determination that comes from home ownership. People save and come to Connecticut and buy their homes. And there's a trust that they have, like a covenant with their communities that they're here, they have their yard, their backyard, the driveway, and all of that would be violated by the laws that are seeking to be passed. And one last thing is there is a lawsuit being brought by one of these activist groups in Woodbridge, and it is challenging 1 acre single family zoning. So we'll stay vigilant. This is a huge part of the work I did for my district and my constituents in Greenwich and Stamford. And I will continue to pay attention to these bills on planning and development, and we will rally the people again.
All right, thanks, Representative Fiorello. Let's go to Senator Ryan Fazio.
Local control is very much on the ballot this year. We both need to stop further infringements upon our local control of planning and zoning here in southwestern Connecticut and Greenwich in particular. But we also need to reform the laws on the books, which undermine local control and have failed to advance affordable housing goals in a sustainable and reasonable fashion. So Kimberly talked about some of the awful bills that she's seen on the Housing Committee, one of which includes the Fair Share Act, which would essentially double the 830G mandate in another form on our localities. So if you don't like 830G now, just wait, because if the housing chairman, if the House Majority Leader have big enough majorities this coming term, then they will be enabled to pass that bill, which they authored and introduced, and impose it upon municipalities like Greenwich and New Canaan and Stamford. But we also need to change 830G. Now, for any of the listeners who aren't exactly aware, 830G allows any developer under state law to do a full end round around the planning and zoning rules of a municipality if they meet certain state restrictions and regulations on the development they build, specifically 30% deed-restricted affordable housing. Not affordable housing, but deed-restricted affordable housing, which results in certain very dense type of developments that upend neighborhoods. One example in my district, again, I mentioned it earlier in the interview, on Weed Street in New Canaan, there's a single-family neighborhood I was just with last night, one of the residents there who just moved there with his young family. And in that single-family zone neighborhood, there is now a 100-unit development being applied for under the 830G regulations, where there is essentially no check that the town or the community has on that type of construction because of the 830G law. Even though Places like New Canaan and Greenwich are working very hard to advance their affordable housing goals and have been in recent years. So there's a much better way on this. And I introduced with some colleagues a bill to actually change and overhaul 830G so that we have more local input and that we can advance affordable housing goals in a way that we don't totally upend neighborhoods and communities. So not only, I think, is there a problem with the state government as is and a state policy as is and significant risks in further undermining local control, but I think the candidates here tonight do have a better way forward. There is better options, and we can provide better leadership.
All right, Senator Fazio, Ed Lopez.
So this is an issue that really affects my district. We have a lot of density in one side of my district. And on the RTM, I think I probably started raising a lot of hell on this issue because I felt like a lot of it was coming to our side. The problem with that is you create a lot of there are a lot of collateral issues, and a lot of them are municipal. But I think at the end of the day, if we can't manage what's happening in Hartford, it makes it tough for the town to manage these issues here locally. And those issues include things like parking. You have collateral issues like, for example, overpaving. And that overpaving also has an effect on a lot of environmental issues. And so a lot of the same people that support these policies are the ones that advocate for the environment. So the irony is that you have things that are being problems created by these policies that they're not accounting for when they discuss these issues. The other thing that I'm not comfortable with is the premise that Greenwich is not a diverse community. My district is very diverse. I think all of Greenwich is very diverse. You know, when I'm knocking doors, I'm surprised not only by the fact that it's so diverse, but also by the variety of political opinions. You know, people can't make assumptions about where people sit politically based on their ethnic background, demographics. Those are important things that I keep in mind. But it's just using that as an argument to push policies from Hartford to Greenwich that are so unfair, that don't take into account people's voices. They don't take into account the decisions that local residents would like to make with respect to these policies. That's a concern. You know, when I walk around Riverside and I see a lot of Sudamericanos, you know, a lot of South Americans, and I go to Byram or Chickahominy, and yesterday on Rich Street I stopped by a person's house, a constituent. Her name's Jeannie, and it smelled so great. I had to ask her what she was cooking. She gave me a couple of Jamaican dumplings, and it was like one of the best things in my my door knocking. But the point is, you know, I think that to argue that Greenwich is not a diverse place is actually, in a lot of ways, it's disrespectful to the people that live here and who are affected by a lot of this density that comes with these bad policies.
All right, Ed Lopez, Peter Scheer.
Yeah, like Ed in the 151st District, this is an enormous issue. We had in our district, two of the most controversial 830G law-enabled projects. One was at the corner of the Post Road and Brookside Drive, which is right near Greenwich High School, as well as Indian Field and Stanwich Roads, where it was proposed to put up a five-story, 86-unit apartment building right on the Post Road with absolutely no infrastructure able to support it. And I will tell you, because I have kids in Greenwich schools, I couldn't imagine what that would have done to the traffic that's already there around the high school, as well as people trying to get down to I-95 and the train stations in Coscob and Greenwich. The other one that came up in our district was a seven-story, and I just want you to visualize this, a seven-story, 192-unit proposal in the middle of one of our most historic districts, the Fourth Ward, which is right behind the Post Road by by Greenwich Hospital. It's the place where the AME Church is, which is a historic. The housing in there is absolutely beautiful and quaint, and all of it is historic, much of it from not the 20th century, the 19th century. And 830G, which is a mandate coming out of Hartford that hasn't worked to address affordable housing after it's almost 30 years old now, I believe it is, as a law. It just hasn't worked. It's bad policy. It would destroy these neighborhoods. So I'm standing strongly against this. I don't support these heavy-handed, master plan-drawn things. Even in Greenwich, we have those. where with our plan of conservation and development, there are some people on the RTM who have just pushed through some very radical agendas in terms of development. I think we need a little different approach. There is no doubt, however, we need more affordable housing in Greenwich. It's absolutely required. But I think there are other better ways to get there. One thing we would have to do for sure is we have to reform 830G. We have to, that's the law, 8-30G is the Connecticut statute we keep referring to. That needs a whole bunch of adjustments. There are just parts of it that haven't worked. But I think we can have some more innovative solutions. So as an example, in the state of Connecticut, the state as well as the municipality collects conveyance taxes for real estate transactions. It's one of those things that Greenwich sends a ton of money up to Hartford, never to be seen again. Well, what I'd like to see happen is that instead of that just dropping into the general fund, I'd like to see the conveyance taxes from the state. First of all, I'd see like the conveyance tax rates cut. But also, I'd like to see that redirected back to municipalities to fund affordable housing trusts. And then communities can make decisions about how to expand their base of affordable housing in a way that fits in with the community and the community values. The other thing I'd like to see is I think the Greenwich Housing Authority, now known as Greenwich Communities, under the leadership of Sam Romeo and others, has done a masterful job of trying to consistently expand the availability of affordable housing through the Housing Authority. I'd like to see us support more of that. We just had a situation reported in the paper today, for example, where various laws are trying to make that too difficult. The last thing we have to do is, in my district, particularly with Cost Cobb and Riverside, the transit-oriented bill, which would wipe out all zoning restrictions in the within a half-mile or mile radius from the post road and from the train stations, which would decimate sections of Cost Cobb and Riverside. We can't allow these things to go forward, and we need intelligent zoning strategies that are decided locally in a local context that provides the varied housing stock we need to support the residents of Greenwich.
All right, that's Peter Sherry. From a timing standpoint, I think we'll have one more question, and I think Ed or Peter brought up the traffic issue. Let's talk traffic then. We'll start with State Representative Kimberly Fiorello. Do you believe anything that can be done about the traffic through Greenwich 95 and so forth?
I was just responding to a constituent who called me about traffic on his street, and so I had a conversation with the first selectman, and I know that Fred Camillo will be doing a townwide traffic study because I think we're all experiencing this issue of traffic in our town that's really impacting our quality of life. So do I have a solution right now? Traffic and infrastructure is it's something that government does do, and it's hard to find the right solution. But I know traffic studies are important, and ways to mitigate how to get traffic to move smoothly and get the signage and technology to keep pushing people through and cars through. It's all part of it. It's not a topic I'm terribly familiar with, except that I suffer in the traffic with everyone else. And when a constituent called to talk about his street, I was eager to respond and learn from Fred what could possibly be done as well.
All right, thanks. So, Senator Fazio.
Well, I think any elected official who could solve traffic problems would be reelected by Saddam Hussein-like levels of support. So certainly we have the incentive. I lived in this town a long time. It feels like traffic's gotten worse. It's one reason why I think the localities, the municipalities, are better suited to regulate planning and zoning and development rather than the state imposing things on our localities, because that could exacerbate traffic even more. Distracted driving probably is one of the main reasons that accidents and traffic have gotten worse in the past 10 or 15 years. Everyone's on their console, on their car, or on their phone in their car. There's probably very few people who aren't guilty of that. But, you know, enforcing those laws, and I think they increase the ticket cost for distracted driving, is probably reasonable. But again, because of the police law, we have fewer cops on the street and enforcing traffic laws. So that's another. And then I do think the traffic studies and you know, pushing the bureaucracy to focusing on alleviating traffic and improving traffic flows. Traffic lights, having the right cadence of the traffic lights. I know that they went kind of through new iterations in Stamford. I'm not sure if it worked or not, but it is the right intention. Even the on-off ramps on 95, you know, making sure those flows are right and that the length and the ability to turn off the highway is there will improve the traffic flows on 95, which is important for commuters and our local economy. So I think there are a few definite no's and there are a few definite yeses in how we can improve things, but it is a very difficult problem.
All right, to Senator Fazio. Ed Lopez.
I have to underscore something Senator Fazio said, which was the point on local control. When I think about developments that would have been permissible, or that might be, because they've been proposed for areas like the Hamilton School area, there's right down the hill you have CVS, and there are a lot of ambitions for these areas, but a lot of these ideas would be permissible by virtue of Hartford policy, not local policy. And I would just dare anybody from Hartford who hasn't seen the traffic there at 2 o'clock around that school to look at how bad it is, and maybe they'd reconsider their policies and ideas all the way up there. I think there are solutions locally, and I think a lot of it has to do with maintaining local control.
All right, Ed Lopez, Peter Scheer.
Yeah, I mean, everybody talks about traffic. If you hit particular parts of town at the wrong time of the day, it's a real issue. I think there's a couple things we can do. You know, I have a longstanding technology background, and there are lots of tried and true traffic solutions leveraged through the most state-of-the-art technology for traffic management. I know I used to work for a large German firm, Siemens. They excelled in that, and if you've ever gone on roads in Germany, you see how well it works. So I think we need to work with the state. You know, the most important thoroughfare through our town other than I-95 is essentially the Post Road. It's a state road. And fortunately, with Fred Camillo and his team in the town government, they've cultivated a open, collaborative relationship with the state to try to work on mitigating traffic. And we need to keep doing that. I think Fred's got the right idea to keep – you have to – monitor and measure what you expect. And that's a really important thing to do. I will tell you also, coming from a school's perspective, I spent a lot of time, particularly when we changed the start time at the high school, which was one of the most important mental health things we could do for students, affecting thousands of students. It had a big impact on traffic. And there was a lot that we could do associated with that. One of the things we can do is provide a better transportation network in our schools, not only our public schools, but also our private schools. Many people don't know that private schools are entitled to bus transportation from the public school. It's a state law in Connecticut. And if we can properly manage those school networks, we can get cars off the street and getting kids onto buses. These are just good things. They're good for the environment. They're good for traffic. They're good for everybody's mental health, and we can do that. But right now, as an example at the Board of Ed, I'm getting these notes all the time about the disaster that has been the transportation network this year. So we need to look at how we can bolster and help boards of education get cars off the road. The other thing that's really important in my district about traffic is, because I cover Riverside will cover Riverside and Coscob in the 151st District, is we have two exits. We have exit 5 and we have exit 4. And exit 5, that intersection is a real issue. And as Ryan said, you know, working collaboratively with the State Department of Transportation and other state agencies, that's a critical issue. The other thing that's a really critical issue in the 151st District is the noise associated with I-95. It impacts people. It impacts their health. It's something that town officials and even elected officials, Harry Aurora and others, have worked on. But we need to get at the problem of better managing the traffic on I-95. We need to get better at managing the noise. And that's going to be a technology solution, or one of the ways we'll do that is through some better technology solutions. So this whole area of transportation and traffic. One of the worst ideas that I think ever came out of Hartford, which was around for a while, was the idea, and I hope Governor Lamont doesn't have visions of bringing this back, which is tolling I-95. It's a huge tax on our people. It's a tax on the affordability of people. That would be a transportation solution that I hope does not resurface and cooler heads do prevail. There are other things we can do in transportation to make it work better in Greenwich and in southwestern Connecticut, particularly because in Greenwich we're the gateway to Connecticut from the mid-Atlantic states. And we just need to all come together in a collaborative way, thinking about the most innovative technology solutions to manage traffic on 95, traffic coming off of 95, and then traffic just generated within our town.
All right, that's Peter Scheer, and I want to thank all the candidates for coming in today to share their thoughts. Election Day is, what, less than 5 weeks away?
We feel it, Tony.
You're feeling it after all these times. 2,000 people. Get the clicker out there for more. All right, we've had Ryan Fazio, State Senator, Incumbent State Representative Kimberly Fiorello, Peter Scheer, who is running for the 151st House seat, the open seat, and Ed Lopez challenging Stephen Mesker in the 150th. I want to thank all four of you for coming in today.
Tony, can I also just
Thank you, Tony.
Can I also say we really want to thank the Greenwich Sentinel as well. We know this is a joint effort between WGCH and the Greenwich Sentinel, and it's so nice to see the local press making sure that voters in Greenwich are informed by hosting these kinds of nonpartisan forums. I just want to thank you guys for doing this.
All right. And on that note, hope to have the Democratic candidates come in also for a similar forum in the days and weeks to come. Thanks to all four of you. Good luck on Election Day.
Thank you for coming in.
All right, that'll do it. And want to pass along thanks once again to Sam Romeo for ceding his 2 hours today for Greenwich Matters. You can join Sam next week on Greenwich Matters from 6